The Ego and His Own by Max Stirner, continued, Cassette 2, Side 2. Whether this will is regarded as reasonable or as unreasonable, in both cases one acts morally when one follows it, and immorally when one breaks away from it. The will that commands the censorship seems to many unreasonable, but he who in a land of censorship evades the censoring of his book acts immorally, and he who submits it to the censorship acts morally. If someone let his moral judgment go and set up a secret press, one would have to call him immoral and imprudent in the bargain if he let himself be caught. But will such a man lay claim to a value in the eyes of the moral? Perhaps, that is, if he fancied he was serving a higher morality. The web of the hypocrisy of today hangs on the frontiers of two domains, between which our time swings back and forth, attaching its fine threads of deception and self-deception. No longer vigorous enough to serve morality without doubt or weakening, not yet reckless enough to live wholly up to egoism, it trembles now toward the one and now toward the other in the spider web of hypocrisy, and, crippled by the curse of halfness, catches only miserable, stupid flies. If one has once dared to make a free motion, immediately one waters it again with assurances of love and shams resignation. If, on the other side, they have had the face to reject the free motion with moral appeals to confidence, immediately the moral courage also sinks, and they assure one how they hear the free words with special pleasure. They sham approval. In short, people would like to have the one but not go without the other. They would like to have a free will, but not for their lives lack the moral will. Just come in contact with a servile loyalist, you liberals. You will sweeten every word of freedom with a look of the most loyal confidence, and he will clothe his servilism in the most flattering phrases of freedom. Then you go apart, and he, like you, thinks, "I know you, Fox." He scents the devil in you, as much as you do the dark old Lord God in him. A Nero is a bad man only in the eyes of the good. In mine he is nothing but a possessed man, as are the good too. The good see in him an arch-villain and relegate him to hell. Why did nothing hinder him in his arbitrary course? Why did people put up with so much? Do you suppose the tame Romans, who let all their will be bound by such a tyrant, were a hair the better? In old Rome, they would have put him to death instantly, would never have been his slaves. But the contemporary good among the Romans opposed to him only moral demands, not their will. They sighed that their emperor did not do homage to morality like them. They themselves remained moral subjects, till at last one found courage to give up moral obedient subjection. And then the same good Romans, who, as obedient subjects, had borne all the ignominy of having no will, hurrahed over the nefarious, immoral act of the rebel. Where then in the good was the courage for the revolution, that courage which they now praised after another had mustered it up? The good could not have this courage, for a revolution and an insurrection into the bargain is always something immoral, which one can resolve upon only when one ceases to be good and becomes either bad or neither of the two. Nero was no viler than his time, in which one could only be one of the two, good or bad. The judgment of his time on him had to be that he was bad, and this in the highest degree, not a milksop but an arch scoundrel. All moral people can pronounce only this judgment on him. Rascals such as he was are still living here and there today. See, for example, the memoirs of Ritter von Lang in the midst of the moral. It is not convenient to live among them, certainly, as one is not sure of his life for a moment. But can you say that it is more convenient to live among the moral? One is just as little sure of his life there, only that one is hanged in the way of justice. But least of all is one sure of his honor, and the national cockade is gone before you can say Jack Robinson. The hard fist of morality treats the noble nature of egoism altogether without compassion. But surely one cannot put a rascal and an honest man on the same level. Now, no human being does that oftener than you judges of morals. Yes, still more than that, you imprison as a criminal an honest man who speaks openly against the existing Constitution, against the hallowed institutions, and you entrust portfolios and still more important things to a crafty rascal. So in praxe, you have nothing to reproach me with. But in theory? Now there I do put both on the same level, as two opposite poles, to wit, both on the level of the moral law. Both have meaning only in the moral world. Just as in the pre-Christian time, a Jew who kept the law and one who broke it had meaning and significance only in respect to the Jewish law. Before Jesus Christ, on the contrary, the Pharisee was no more than the sinner and publican. So before self-ownership, the moral Pharisee amounts to as much as the immoral sinner. Nero became very inconvenient by his possessiveness. But a self-owning man would not sillily oppose to him the sacred, and whine if the tyrant does not regard the sacred. He would oppose to him his will. How often the sacredness of the inalienable rights of man has been held up to their foes, and some liberty or other shown and demonstrated to be a sacred right of man. Those who do that deserve to be laughed out of court, as they actually are, were it not that in truth they do, even though unconsciously, take the road that leads to the goal. They have a presentiment that if only the majority is once won for that liberty, it will also will the liberty, and will then take what it will have. The sacredness of the liberty, and all possible proofs of this sacredness, will never procure it. Lamenting and petitioning only shows beggars. The moral man is necessarily narrow in that he knows no other enemy than the immoral man. He who is not moral is immoral, and accordingly reprobate, despicable, etc. Therefore, the moral man can never comprehend the egoist. Is not unwedded cohabitation an immorality? The moral man may turn as he pleases. He will have to stand by this verdict. Emilia Galotti gave up her life for this moral truth. And it is true. It is an immorality. A virtuous girl may become an old maid. A virtuous man may pass the time in fighting his natural impulses till he has perhaps dulled them. He may castrate himself for the sake of virtue, as St. Origen did for the sake of heaven. He thereby honors sacred wedlock, sacred chastity, as inviolable. He is moral. Unchastity can never become a moral act. However indulgently the moral man may judge and excuse him who committed it, it remains a transgression, a sin against a moral commandment. There clings to it an indelible stain. As chastity once belonged to the monastic vow, so it does to moral conduct. Chastity is a good. For the egoist, on the contrary, even chastity is not a good without which he could not get along. He cares nothing at all about it. What now follows from this for the judgment of the moral man? This, that he throws the egoist into the only class of men that he knows besides moral men, into that of the immoral. He cannot do otherwise. He must find the egoist immoral in everything in which the egoist disregards morality. If he did not find him so, then he would already have become an apostate from morality without confessing it to himself. He would already no longer be a truly moral man. One should not let himself be led astray by such phenomena, which at the present day are certainly no longer to be classed as rare, but should reflect that he who yields any point of morality can as little be counted among the truly moral as Lessing was a pious Christian when, in the well-known parable, he compared the Christian religion, as well as the Mohammedan and Jewish, to a counterfeit ring. Often people are already further than they venture to confess to themselves. For Socrates, because in culture he stood on the level of morality, it would have been an immorality if he had been willing to follow Crito's seductive incitement and escape from the dungeon. To remain was the only moral thing. But it was solely because Socrates was a moral man. The unprincipled, sacrilegious men of the revolution, on the contrary, had sworn fidelity to Louis XVI and decreed his deposition, yes, his death. But the act was an immoral one, at which moral persons will be horrified to all eternity. Yet all this applies more or less only to civic morality, on which the freer look down with contempt. For it, like civism, its native ground in general, is still too little removed and free from the religious heaven not to transplant the latter's laws without criticism or further consideration to its domain, instead of producing independent doctrines of its own. Morality cuts a quite different figure when it arrives at the consciousness of its dignity and raises its principle, the essence of man, or man with a capital M, to be the only regulative power. Those who have worked their way through to such a decided consciousness break entirely with religion, whose God no longer finds any place alongside their man with a capital M, and as they, see below, themselves scuttle the ship of state, so, too, they crumble away that morality which flourishes only in the state, and logically have no right to use even its name any further. for what this critical party calls morality is very positively distinguished from the so-called civic or political morality, and must appear to the citizen like an insensate and unbridled liberty. But at bottom, it has only the advantage of the purity of the principle, which, freed from its defilement with the religious, has now reached universal power in its clarified definiteness as humanity. Therefore, one should not wonder that the name morality is retained along with others like freedom, benevolence, self-consciousness, and is only garnished now and then with the addition a free morality. Just as, though the civic state is abused, yet the state is to arise again as a free state, or if not even so, yet as a free society. Because this morality completed into humanity has fully settled its accounts with the religion out of which it historically came forth, nothing hinders it from becoming a religion on its own account. For a distinction prevails between religion and morality only so long as our dealings with the world of men are regulated and hallowed by our relation to a superhuman being, or so long as our doing is a doing for God's sake. If, on the other hand, it comes to the point that man is to man the supreme being, then that distinction vanishes, and morality, being removed from its subordinate position, is completed into religion. For then, the higher being who had hitherto been subordinated to the highest, man, has ascended to absolute height, and we are related to him as one is related to the highest being, religiously. Morality and piety are now as synonymous as in the beginning of Christianity, and it is only because the supreme being has come to be a different one that a holy walk is no longer called a holy one, but a human one. If morality has conquered, then a complete change of masters has taken place. After the annihilation of faith, Feuerbach thinks to put into the supposedly safe harbor of love. The first and highest law must be the love of man to man. Homo homini deus est. This is the supreme practical maxim. This is the turning point of the world's history. But properly speaking, only the God is changed, the deus. Love has remained. There love to the superhuman God, here love to the human God, to homo as deus. Therefore, man is to me sacred, and everything truly human is to me sacred. Marriage is sacred of itself, and so it is with all moral relations. Friendship is and must be sacred for you, and property, and marriage, and the good of every man, but sacred in and of itself. Haven't we the priest again there? Who is his God? Man, with a great M. What is the divine? The human. Then the predicate has indeed only been changed into the subject. And instead of the sentence, God is love, they say, love is divine. Instead of God has become man has become God, etc. It is nothing more or less than a new religion. All moral relations are ethical, are cultivated with a moral mind, only where, of themselves, without religious consecration by the priest's blessing, they are counted religious. Feuerbach's proposition, theology is anthropology, means only, religion must be ethics. Ethics alone is religion. Altogether, Feuerbach accomplishes only a transposition of subject and predicate, a giving of preference to the latter. But since he himself says, love is not, and has never been considered by men, sacred through being a predicate of God, but it is a predicate of God because it is divine in and of itself, he might judge that the fight against the predicates themselves, against love and all sanctities, must be commenced. How could he hope to turn men away from God when he left them the divine? And if, as Feuerbach says, God himself has never been the main thing to them, but only his predicates, then he might have gone on leaving them the tinsel longer yet, since the doll, the real kernel, was left at any rate. He recognizes, too, that with him it is only a matter of annihilating an illusion. He thinks, however, that the effect of the illusion on men is downright ruinous, since even love, in itself the truest, most inward sentiment, becomes an obscure, illusory one through religiousness, since religious love loves man only for God's sake, therefore loves man only apparently, but in truth, God only. Is this different with moral love? Does it love the man, for this man's sake, or for morality's sake, and so, for homo homini deus, for God's sake? The wheels in the head have a number of other formal aspects, some of which it may be useful to indicate here. Thus, self-renunciation is common to the holy with the unholy, to the pure and the impure. The impure man renounces all better feelings, all shame, even natural timidity, and follows only the appetite that rules him. The pure man renounces his natural relation to the world, renounces the world, and follows only the desire which rules him. Driven by the thirst for money, the avaricious man renounces all admonitions of conscience, all feeling of honor, all gentleness, and all compassion. He puts all considerations out of sight. The appetite drags him along. The holy man behaves similarly. He makes himself the laughingstock of the world, is hard-hearted and strictly just, for the desire drags him along. As the unholy man renounces himself before mammon, so the holy man renounces himself before God and the divine laws. We are now living in a time when the shamelessness of the holy is every day more and more felt and uncovered, whereby it is at the same time compelled to unveil itself and lay itself bare more and more every day. Have not the shamelessness and stupidity of the reasons with which men antagonize the progress of the age long surpassed all measure and all expectation? But it must be so. The self-renouncers must, as holy men, take the same course that they do as unholy men. As the latter little by little sink to the fullest measure of self-renouncing vulgarity and lowness, so the former must ascend to the most dishonorable exaltation. The mammon of the earth and the God of heaven both demand exactly the same degree of self-renunciation. The low man, like the exalted one, reaches out for a good, the former for the material good, the latter for the ideal, the so-called supreme good, and at last both complete each other again, too, as the materially minded man sacrifices everything to an ideal phantasm, his vanity, and the spiritually minded man to a material gratification, the life of enjoyment. Those who exhort men to unselfishness think they are saying an uncommon deal. What do they understand by it? Probably something like what they understand by self-renunciation. But who is this self that is to be renounced and to have no benefit? It seems that you, yourself, are supposed to be it. And for whose benefit is unselfish self-renunciation recommended to you? Again, for your benefit and behoof. Only that through unselfishness you are procuring your true benefit. You are to benefit yourself, and yet you are not to seek your benefit. People regard as unselfish the benefactor of men, a Franca who founded the orphan asylum, an O'Connell who works tirelessly for his Irish people, but also the fanatic who, like St. Boniface, hazards his life for the conversion of the heathen, or, like Robespierre, sacrifices everything to virtue, like Kerner, dies for God, King, and Fatherland. Hence, among others, O'Connell's opponents try to trump up against him some selfishness or mercenariness, for which the O'Connell Fund seemed to give them a foundation. For if they were successful in casting suspicion on his unselfishness, they would easily separate him from his adherents. Yet what could they show further than that O'Connell was working for another end than the ostensible one? But whether he may aim at making money or at liberating the people, it still remains certain, in one case as in the other, that he is striving for an end, and that his end. Selfishness here as there, only that his national self-interest would be beneficial to others too, and so would be for the common interest. Now, do you suppose unselfishness is unreal and nowhere extant? On the contrary, nothing is more ordinary. One may even call it an article of fashion in the civilized world, which is considered so indispensable that, if it costs too much in solid material, people at least adorn themselves with its tinsel counterfeit and feign it. Where does unselfishness begin? Right where an end ceases to be our end and our property, which we as owners can dispose of at pleasure. Where it becomes a fixed end or a fixed idea, where it begins to inspire, enthuse, fanaticize us, in short, where it passes into our stubbornness and becomes our master. One is not unselfish so long as he retains the end in his power. One becomes so only at that, here I stand, I cannot do otherwise, the fundamental maxim of all the possessed. One becomes so in the case of a sacred end, through the corresponding sacred zeal. I am not unselfish so long as the end remains my own, and I, instead of giving myself up to be the blind means of its fulfillment, leave it always an open question. My zeal need not on that account be slacker than the most fanatical, but at the same time I remain toward it frostily cold, unbelieving, and its most irreconcilable enemy. I remain its judge, because I am its owner. Unselfishness grows rank as far as possessedness reaches, as much on possessions of the devil as on those of a good spirit. There vice, folly, and the like, here humility, devotion, and so forth. Where could one look without meeting victims of self-renunciation? There sits a girl opposite me, who perhaps has been making bloody sacrifices to her soul for 10 years already. Over the buxom form droops a deathly tired head, and pale cheeks betray the slow bleeding away of her youth. Poor child, how often the passions may have beaten at your heart, and the rich powers of youth have demanded their right. When your head rolled in the soft pillow, how awakening nature quivered through your limbs, the blood swelled your veins, and fiery fancies poured the gleam of voluptuousness into your eyes. Then appeared the ghost of the soul and its external bliss. You were terrified, your hands folded themselves, your tormented eyes turned its look upward, you prayed. The storms of nature were hushed, a calm glided over the ocean of your appetites. Slowly the weary eyelids sank over the life extinguished under them. The tension crept out unperceived from the rounded limbs. The boisterous waves dried up in the heart. The folded hands themselves rested a powerless weight on the unresisting bosom. One last faint, "Oh dear," moaned itself away, and the soul was at rest. You fell asleep, to awake in the morning to a new combat and a new prayer. Now the habit of renunciation cools the heat of your desire, and the roses of your youth are growing pale in the chlorosis of your heavenliness. The soul is saved, the body may perish. O Laius, O Ninon, how well you did to scorn this pale virtue! One free grisette against 1,000 virgins grown gray in virtue. The fixed idea may also be perceived as maxim, principle, standpoint, and the like. Archimedes, to move the earth, asked for a standpoint outside it. Men sought continually for this standpoint, and every one seized upon it as well as he was able. This foreign standpoint is the world of mind, of ideas, thoughts, concepts, essences. It is heaven. Heaven is the standpoint from which the earth is moved, earthly doings surveyed and despised. To assure to themselves heaven, to occupy the heavenly standpoint firmly and forever, how painfully and tirelessly humanity struggled for this. Christianity has aimed to deliver us from a life determined by nature, from the appetites as actuating us, and so has meant that man should not let himself be determined by his appetites. This does not involve the idea that he was not to have appetites, but that the appetites were not to have him, that they were not to become fixed, uncontrollable, indissoluble. Now, could not what Christianity, religion, contrived against the appetites be applied by us to its own precept that mind, thought, conceptions, ideas, faith must determine us? Could we not ask that neither should mind or the conception, the idea, be allowed to determine us, to become fixed and inviolable or sacred? Then it would end in the dissolution of mind, the dissolution of all thoughts, of all conceptions. As we there had to say, we are indeed to have appetites, but the appetites are not to have us, so we should now say, we are indeed to have mind, but mind is not to have us. If the latter seems lacking in sense, think of the fact that with so many a man a thought becomes a maxim, whereby he himself is made prisoner to it, so that it is not he that has the maxim, but rather it that has him. And with the maxim he has a permanent standpoint again. The doctrines of the catechism become our principles before we find it out, and no longer brook rejection. Their thought, or mind, has the sole power, and no protest of the flesh is further listened to. Nevertheless, it is only through the flesh that I can break the tyranny of mind. For it is only when a man hears his flesh along with the rest of him that he hears himself wholly, and it is only when he wholly hears himself that he is a hearing or rational being. The Christian does not hear the agony of his enthralled nature, but lives in humility. Therefore he does not grumble at the wrong which befalls his person. He thinks himself satisfied with the freedom of the spirit. But if the flesh once takes the floor, and its tone is passionate, indecorous, not well disposed, spiteful, as it cannot be otherwise, then he thinks he hears voices of devils, voices against the spirit, for decorum, passionlessness, kindly disposition, and the like, is spirit, and is justly zealous against them. He could not be a Christian if he were willing to endure them. He listens only to morality and slaps unmorality in the mouth. He listens only to legality and gags the lawless word. The spirit of morality and legality holds him a prisoner, a rigid, unbending master. They call that the mastery of the spirit. It is, at the same time, the standpoint of the spirit. And now, whom do the ordinary liberal gentlemen mean to make free? Whose freedom is it that they cry out and thirst for? The spirit's. That of the spirit of morality, legality, piety, the fear of God. That is what the anti-liberal gentlemen also want, and the whole contention between the two turns on a matter of advantage, whether the latter are to be the only speakers, or the former are to receive a share in the enjoyment of the same advantage. The spirit remains the absolute lord for both, and their only quarrel is over who shall occupy the hierarchical throne that pertains to the vice-regent of the Lord. The best of it is that one can calmly look upon the stir with the certainty that the wild beasts of history will tear each other to pieces just like those of nature. Their putrefying corpses fertilize the ground for our crops. We shall come back later to many another wheel in the head, for instance, those of vocation, truthfulness, love, and the like. When one's own is contrasted with what is imparted to him, there is no use in objecting that we cannot have anything isolated, but receive everything as a part of the universal order, and therefore through the impression of what is around us, and that consequently we have it as something imparted. For there is a great difference between the feelings and thoughts which are aroused in me by other things, and those which are given to me. God, immortality, freedom, humanity are drilled into us from childhood as thoughts and feelings which move our inner sense more or less strongly, either ruling us without our knowing it, or, sometimes in richer natures, manifesting themselves in systems and works of art, but are always not aroused but imparted feelings, because we must believe in them and cling to them. That an absolute existed, and that it must be taken in, felt, and thought by us, was settled as a faith in the minds of those who spent all the strength of their mind on recognizing it and setting it forth. The feeling for the absolute exists there as an imparted one, and thenceforth results only in the most manifold revelations of its own self. So in Klopstock, the religious feeling was an imparted one, which in the Messiah simply found artistic expression. If, on the other hand, the religion with which he was confronted had been for him only an incitation to feeling and thought, and if he had known how to take an attitude completely his own toward it, then there would have resulted, instead of religious inspiration, a dissolution and consumption of the religion itself. Instead of that, he only continued in mature years his childish feelings received in childhood, and squandered the powers of his manhood in decking out his childish trifles. The difference is, then, whether feelings are imparted to me or only aroused. Those which are aroused are my own, egoistic, because they are not as feelings drilled into me, dictated to me, and pressed upon me. But those which are imparted to me I receive with open arms. I cherish them in me as a heritage, cultivate them, and am possessed by them. Who is there that has never, more or less consciously, noticed that our whole education is calculated to produce feelings in us, impart them to us, instead of leaving their production to ourselves, however they may turn out? If we hear the name of God, we are to feel veneration. If we hear that of the Prince's Majesty, it is to be received with reverence, deference, submission. If we hear that of morality, we are to think that we hear something inviolable. If we hear of the evil one or evil ones, we are to shudder. The intention is directed to these feelings, and he who should hear with pleasure the deeds of the bad would have to be taught what's what with the rod of discipline. Thus, stuffed with imparted feelings, we appear before the bar of majority and are pronounced of age. Our equipment consists of elevating feelings, lofty thoughts, inspiring maxims, eternal principles. The young are of age when they twitter like the old. They are driven through school to learn the old song, and when they have this by heart, they are declared of age. We must not feel at everything and every name that comes before us what we could and would like to feel thereat. At the name of God we must think of nothing laughable, feel nothing disrespectful, it being prescribed and imparted to us what and how we are to feel and think at mention of that name. That is the meaning of the care of souls, that my soul or my mind be tuned as others think right, not as I myself would like it. How much trouble does it not cost one, finally, to secure to oneself a feeling of one's own at the mention of at least this or that name, and to laugh in the face of many who expect from us a holy face and a composed expression at their speeches? What is imparted is alien to us, is not our own, and therefore is sacred, and it is hard work to lay aside the sacred dread of it. Today one again hears seriousness praised. Seriousness in the presence of highly important subjects and discussions, German seriousness, and so on. This sort of seriousness proclaims clearly how old and grave lunacy and possession have already become. For there is nothing more serious than a lunatic when he comes to the central point of his lunacy. Then his great earnestness incapacitates him for taking a joke. See Madhouses. 3. The Hierarchy. The historical reflections on our Mongolism, which I propose to insert episodically at this place, are not given with the claim of thoroughness, or even of approved soundness, but solely because it seems to me that they may contribute toward making the rest clear. The history of the world, whose shaping properly belongs altogether to the Caucasian race, seems till now to have run through two Caucasian ages, in the first of which we had to work out and work off our innate negroidity. This was followed in the second by mongoloidity, Chineseness, which must likewise be terribly made an end of. Negroidity represents antiquity, the time of dependence on things, on cocks eating, birds flight, on sneezing, on thunder and lightning, on the rustling of sacred trees, and so forth. Mongoloidity, the time of dependence on thoughts, the Christian time. Reserved for the future are the words, I am owner of the world of things, and I am owner of the world of mind. In the Negroid age fall the campaigns of Sesostris, and the importance of Egypt, and of northern Africa in general. To the Mongoloid age belong the invasions of the Huns and Mongols, up to the Russians. The value of me cannot possibly be rated high so long as the hard diamond of the not-me bears so enormous a price, as was the case both with God and with the world. The not-me is still too stony and indomitable to be consumed and absorbed by me. Rather, men only creep about with extraordinary bustle on this immovable entity, on this substance, like parasitic animals on a body from whose juices they draw nourishment, yet without consuming it. It is the bustle of vermin, the assiduity of Mongolians. Among the Chinese, we know, everything remains as it used to be, and nothing essential or substantial suffers a change. All the more actively do they work away at that which remains, which bears the name of the old, ancestors, and the like. Accordingly, in our Mongolian age, all change has been only reformatory or ameliorative, not destructive or consuming and annihilating. The substance, the object, remains. All our assiduity was only the activity of ants and the hopping of fleas, jugglers' tricks on the immovable tightrope of the objective, corvée service under the leadership of the unchangeable or eternal. The Chinese are doubtless the most positive nation, because totally buried in precepts. But neither has the Christian age come out from the positive, from limited freedom, freedom within certain limits. In the most advanced stage of civilization, this activity earns the name of scientific activity, of working on a motionless presupposition, a hypothesis that is not to be upset. In its first and most unintelligible form, morality shows itself as habit. To act according to the habit and usage, mores, of one's country, is to be moral there. Therefore, pure moral action, clear, unadulterated morality, is most straightforwardly practiced in China. They keep to the old habit and usage, and hate each innovation as a crime worthy of death. For innovation is the deadly enemy of habit, of the old, of permanence. In fact, too, it admits of no doubt that through habit man secures himself against the obtrusiveness of things, of the world, and founds a world of his own in which alone he is and feels at home, builds himself a heaven. Why, heaven has no other meaning than that it is man's proper home, in which nothing alien regulates and rules him any longer, no influence of the earthly any longer makes him himself alien. in short, in which the dross of the earthly is thrown off, and the combat against the world has found an end, in which, therefore, nothing is any longer denied him. Heaven is the end of abnegation, it is free enjoyment. There, man no longer denies himself anything, because nothing is any longer alien and hostile to him. But now, habit is a second nature, which detaches and frees man from his first and original natural condition, in securing him against every casualty of it. The fully elaborated habit of the Chinese has provided for all emergencies, and everything is looked out for. Whatever may come, the Chinaman always knows how he has to behave, and does not need to decide first according to the circumstances. No unforeseen case throws him down from the heaven of his rest. The morally habituated and inured Chinaman is not surprised and taken off his guard. He behaves with equanimity, that is, with equal spirit or temper, toward everything, because his temper, protected by the precaution of his traditional usage, does not lose its balance. Hence, on the ladder of culture or civilization, humanity mounts the first round through habit. And as it conceives that, in climbing to culture, it is at the same time climbing to heaven, the realm of culture or second nature, it really mounts the first round of the ladder to heaven. If Mongoldom has settled the existence of spiritual beings, if it has created a world of spirits, a heaven, the Caucasians have wrestled for thousands of years with these spiritual beings to get to the bottom of them. What were they doing then but building on Mongolian ground? They have not built on sand, but in the air. They have wrestled with Mongolism, stormed the Mongolian heaven, Tian. When will they at last annihilate this heaven? When will they at last become really Caucasians and find themselves? When will the immortality of the soul, which in these latter days thought it was giving itself still more security if it presented itself as immortality of mind, at last change to the mortality of mind? It was when, in the industrious struggle of the Mongolian race, men had built a heaven, that those of the Caucasian race, since in their Mongolian complexion they have to do with heaven, took upon themselves the opposite task, the task of storming that heaven of custom, heaven-storming activity. To dig under all human ordinance in order to set up a new and better one on the cleared site, to wreck all customs in order to put new and better customs in their place, their act is limited to this. But is it thus already purely and really what it aspires to be, and does it reach its final aim? No. In this creation of a better, it is tainted with Mongolism. It storms heaven only to make a heaven again. It overthrows an old power only to legitimate a new power. It only improves. Nevertheless, the point aimed at, often as it may vanish from the eyes at every new attempt, is the real, complete downfall of heaven, customs, in short, of man secured only against the world, of the isolation or inwardness of man. Through the heaven of culture, man seeks to isolate himself from the world, to break its hostile power. But this isolation of heaven must likewise be broken, and the true end of heaven storming is the downfall of heaven, the annihilation of heaven. Improving and reforming is the Mongolism of the Caucasian, because thereby he is always getting up again what already existed, to wit, a precept, a generality, a heaven. He harbors the most irreconcilable enmity to heaven, and yet builds new heavens daily, piling heaven on heaven. He only crushes one by another. The Jews' heaven destroys the Greeks, the Christians the Jews, the Protestants the Catholics. If the heaven-storming men of Caucasian blood throw off their Mongolian skin, they will bury the emotional man under the ruins of the monstrous world of emotion, the isolated man under his isolated world, the paradisical man under his heaven. And heaven is the realm of spirits, the realm of freedom of the spirit. The realm of heaven, the realm of spirits and ghosts, has found its right standing in the speculative philosophy. Here it was stated as the realm of thoughts, concepts, and ideas. Heaven is peopled with thoughts and ideas, and this realm of spirits is then the true reality. To want to win freedom for the spirit is Mongolism. Freedom of the spirit is Mongolian freedom, freedom of feeling, moral freedom, and so forth. We may find the word morality taken as synonymous with spontaneity, self-determination. But that is not involved in it. Rather has the Caucasian shown himself spontaneous only in spite of his Mongolian morality. the Mongolian heaven, or morals, remained the strong castle, and only by storming incessantly at this castle did the Caucasian show himself moral. If he had not had to do with morals at all any longer, if he had not had therein his indomitable continual enemy, the relation to morals would cease, and consequently morality would cease. That his spontaneity is still a moral spontaneity, therefore, is just the mongoloidity of it, is a sign that in it he has not arrived at himself. Moral spontaneity corresponds entirely with religious and orthodox philosophy, constitutional monarchy, the Christian state, freedom within certain limits, the limited freedom of the press, or, in a figure, to the hero fettered to a sickbed. Man has not really vanquished shamanism and its spooks till he possesses the strength to lay aside not only the belief in ghosts or in spirits, but also the belief in the spirit. He who believes in a spook no more assumes the introduction of a higher world than he who believes in the spirit, and both seek behind the sensual world a supersensual one. In short, they produce and believe another world, and this other world, the product of their mind, is a spiritual world. For their senses grasp and know nothing of another, a non-sensual world. Only their spirit lives in it. Going on from this Mongolian belief in the existence of spiritual beings to the point that the proper being of man, too, is his spirit, and that all care must be directed to this alone, to the welfare of his soul, is not hard. Influence on the spirit, so-called moral influence, is hereby assured. Hence it is manifest that Mongolism represents utter absence of any rites of the sensuous, represents non-sensuousness and unnature, and that sin and the consciousness of sin was our Mongolian torment that lasted thousands of years. But who then will dissolve the spirit into its nothing? He who, by means of the spirit, set forth nature as the null, finite, transitory, he alone can bring down the spirit too to like nullity. I can. Each one among you can, who does his will as an absolute I. In a word, the egoist can. This book is continued on Cassette 3, Side 1.